This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 31st, 2010. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This issue's lead article, the 2010 Triangle Business Journal Business Person of the Year. Article entitled, Living a Passion, Building a Legacy. Longtime RDU Airport Director John Brantley points to others when asked about credit for development of regional airfield. This article is by Chris Basden from Morrisville. Many years after John Brantley's eyesight grounded his dream of becoming a pilot, his vision for an airport on the rise is a reality. The final phase of Raleigh-Durham International Airport's mammoth Terminal 2 redevelopment soon will open, capping a construction odyssey that's been more than a decade in the making. Planning began in the late 1990s and construction started in 2006. The first phase of the $570 million Terminal 2 project opened 2.5 years later. The second and final phase, the South Concourse, will open in January. The new terminal features 36 gates and, at 920,000 square feet, is almost 3 times larger than its predecessor. The redevelopment stands out among Triangle construction projects because of its size, cost, and iconic status. It is a facility of which we can all be proud of, says Brantley, the airport director. It reflects the quality of the region. Many consider RDU International, the facility, and the organization to be a manifestation of what's best about the region. Over the years, the airport has undergone steady transformation, and Brantley has been the guiding influence for 3 decades. For his hand at guiding the growth of the airport, capped by his role in initiating the Terminal 2 project and ensuring that it will be finished ahead of schedule and on budget, Brantley is Triangle Business Journal's selection as the 2011 Business Person of the Year. Ken Atkins, the Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, sums up Brantley's contribution. He has taken this airport literally to a whole different level. John Calvin Brantley III was born in Raleigh on July 12, 1942, a year before RDU's first commercial air flight to John and Elizabeth Brantley. That was in the early days of air travel, and the young Brantley got his first taste of flight when he was just 7 and traveled with his grandmother on a Capital Airlines DC-3 from Norfolk, Virginia to Raleigh. But it was another activity during those formative years that had an even bigger impact on the future airport director. Brantley's father, who owned a drugstore in downtown Raleigh, used to drive him and his brother Drew around on Sundays for entertainment. It was called Go to Ride, said Brantley, who fondly remembers RDU as one of the frequent destinations. There, the brothers would chase each other around and play while the planes soared in the sky above their heads. It didn't take long for the older of the boys was bitten by the aviation bug. Truly, my being here is due to him doing that, Brantley says of his father's rides. Still, what the young Brantley really yearned to do was to fly one of those birds. Wish as he might, destiny and genetics had different plans for him. In his early teens, Brantley's eyesight was such that he could not qualify to fly planes in the military, which at that time was the primary route to an eventual career as a commercial pilot. So, after graduating from Broughton High School, Brantley enrolled at NC State University with the notion that he might want to design cars for a living. He started out in mechanical engineering, but it only took 1 course in thermodynamics to redirect him. He surmised such a curriculum would lead him into an unglamorous job as, perhaps, a designer of heating and air conditioning systems. And that didn't sound like much fun to me at all, says Brantley. He transferred to civil engineering and earned an undergraduate degree in 1964. He then enrolled at Northwestern University, which is where he met his wife, Marilyn, and obtained a Master of Science in Civil Engineering. Upon graduating, he began building his career in aviation, taking a job with the Federal Aviation Administration, and even operating his own airport planning company. In 1977, he went to work for the only employer he's had since, beginning at RDU as an engineering assistant. Though it had potential The airport was a small, out-of-the-way station that catered more to puddle jumpers than powerful jets. Its general aviation contingent, airport lingo for private planes owned by corporations and individuals, comprised 80% of its flights. The airport boasted a mere 50 employees. Brantley worked his way up the chain of command quickly, ascending to airport director just 5 years after he started at RDU. He couldn't have timed that promotion any better. The Triangle was beginning to fulfill its potential, and the next 3 decades would see phenomenal growth in terms of population and economic activity. Led by Brantley, the little airport in Morrisville would go on to capitalize on the Triangle's growth to spur its own transformation. Over the years, a second terminal, Terminal C, and a second airstrip were added. A parking deck would rise between the terminals, and the general aviation terminal and its surrounding areas would receive a complete overhaul. Those changes and many others were done little by little. "We didn't try to bite off more than we could chew," says Brantley, who points to RDU's AA credit rating as evidence that the airport has been fiscally responsible. The building process has produced a completely different airport than the one Brantley inherited. Today, commercial airlines, not general aviation flights, dominate RDU's operations, with about 10 million passengers traveling through the terminals annually. Today, there are 185 daily, nonstop flights to about 36 different destinations. The Airport Authority generates annual operating revenue in excess of $85 million and employs about 270 people. That's just a small part of the jobs picture, though. A total of 5,000 full-timers and part-timers work at the airport for employers ranging from the Transportation Security Administration to private vendors that sell everything from honey buns to hamburgers. RDU estimated several years ago that its annual economic impact on the region is $12.6 billion. While not working at the airport, Brantley can be found in the community, where he has served in various capacities, including teaching an engineering class at NCSU and volunteering with the Raleigh Rescue Mission and the Raleigh Kiwanis Club. It was to a Kiwanis Club meeting that he was headed in to on August 1991 when Brantley received the news no parent wants to hear. It came in the form of a phone call informing him that his 23-year-old son and namesake, indeed the fourth member of the family line to bear the name John Calvin, had collapsed while working at a local Harris Teeter. The younger Brantley had suffered a massive cerebral hemorrhage and was dead. Like his father before him, Brantley's son has just graduated with a civil engineering degree from NCSU. "Your world changes in an awful hurry," Brantley says today, "and unfortunately there's not a damn thing you can do about it." Brantley is clear. If he had a choice, he would have wanted God to take him instead of his son. "But you don't get to make that choice," he says. Things would get worse before they got better. Brantley's father had died just a year before his son. With his mother already deceased and his brother serving overseas in the military, Brantley was the only one left to close down the drugstore and administer the estate. As a new year rolled around, bringing with it the height of the airport's budgeting season, Brantley had more jobs than he could handle while trying to deal with the grief of his losses. "It was a very hard time for all of us," his wife Marilyn remembers. "It was also literally more than Brantley's heart could bear. He suffered a heart attack in March 1992. Bad as it was, the heart attack served as a call to action that prompted an overhaul in Brantley's life. He changed the ways he lived and worked, including improving his diet and implementing an exercise regime. Only Brantley truly knows how he repaired his soul from the tragedy of losing his oldest son. But anyone who has seen him joke about the fortunes of his beloved wolf pack, or reminisce about courting Marilyn, or passionately advocate on behalf of the airport knows for certain that he did indeed recover. The Brantleys have two other children, Chris, 41, and Brian, 37. One of the keys to understanding the longtime airport director is recognizing that at heart he's an old-school engineer, not a new-age romantic. Indeed, Brantley seems to have stepped straight out of a Hollywood movie about the glory days of NASA. Central casting couldn't have found a better man to run mission control because Brantley has the proverbial right stuff, a candid, no-nonsense style, encyclopedic knowledge of the industry, and above all, get-the-job-done-right competence. Just don't expect him to get sentimental about any of his accomplishments, such as the rebuilding of Terminal 2. Quote, I think that will be known as his legacy, end quote, says RDU Airport Authority Chairman Rob Teer. But Brantley will have none of that kind of talk. I don't see any legacy, he says. I'm not a legacy person. To Brantley, there was simply a job to do, and the team at RDU did it as best they could. And he bristles at having the lion's share of the credit heaped on him. It's never been me, Brantley says. It's a joint accomplishment, and that's the way it ought to be looked at. Yet Brantley was the man at the top, making sure that everything fit. John's done an excellent job, says former RDU Airport Authority member Tim Clancy, who adds that Brantley kept a tight rein on costs while avoiding being stingy. That attitude helped prevent overruns, yet allowed the airport to deliver a terminal that is functional and aesthetically pleasing. The project hasn't been without some hiccups. The original idea was to rebuild what's now Terminal 1, but that proved to be too costly. After settling on remaking Terminal C, Brantley and his team engaged in negotiations to buy American Airlines out of a long-term lease it had signed. Then came September 11, 2001, terrorist attacks and the resulting blow they dealt in terms of lost traffic to the airline industry and to airports. Brantley and his team guided RDU through that challenge while at the same time buying American Airlines out of its lease and lining up the finances for the terminal renovation. I've been in construction 40 years, and I've never seen a job that complicated go that well, Rob Teer says of the Terminal 2 project. And though Brantley may not embrace all the legacy talk, there is a sense that this will be among his last major contributions before he retires. He won't say exactly when he's going to leave, but he has a telling answer when asked how much longer he will be airport director. Not a whole lot longer, says Brantley, who is 68. Everything's got to change in time. As for RDU International, at least one person knows how much it means to John Calvin Brantley III. He loves that airport, says Marilyn Brantley. Next up, a day with John Brantley. Triangle Business Journal staff writer Chris Basden spent a day with RDU Airport Director John Brantley to chronicle a typical day in the life of Brantley. Here's a synopsis of Basden's day with Brantley, which started at Brantley's house. 5:45 a.m. John Brantley wakes up and gets out of bed to prepare for his day. It's later than usual for the airport director of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. He typically gets up around 5 a.m. in order to have time to work out at a nearby wellness center, or sometimes he just takes a walk around the neighborhood. But he eschews those activities today because he has to be ready to meet the journalist who will shadow him the whole day. 6:45 a.m. Brantley eats a bowl of cereal for breakfast. Brantley loves fruit, and he typically tops the cereal with whatever's handy, strawberries, bananas, or blueberries. The latter is particularly easy to come by since Brantley has a blueberry bush in his yard. Airport Authority board member Michael Weeks also has been known to bring Brantley blueberries from bushes he has in Willow Springs. 7 a.m. As Brantley finishes up getting ready, there's one chore he doesn't have to worry about doing, feeding any pets. While the family had cats and dogs while Brantley and wife Marilyn's children were growing up, those animals are long since gone. The official explanation is that there would be no one to take care of the pets when the Brantleys go out of town. But you get the feeling that's more Marilyn's rule than her husband's. I'd love to have a cat back, says Marilyn. But while discussing the house's no pet policy, that has to go. Marilyn is aware of her husband's opinion, but when pressed on the issue, she concedes, I just don't want to trip over a cat. 7:23 a.m. Brantley, briefcase in hand, departs from the front door of his middle-class brick house in North Raleigh and heads to a white Chevrolet Impala for his drive to work. While Brantley is known among the local business community, it's unlikely he's the most famous person in his neighborhood. That honor would go to former NC State basketball standout Chuck Nevitt, who lives two doors down. On the way to work, Brantley listens to a special radio that allows him to hear the electronic communications of the airport authority's operations personnel. 7:46 a.m. Brantley pulls into the parking lot of the airport authority, which is located on the same road as the rental car company's lot. The white two-story building is owned by the authority, but it also houses the economic developers from the Research Triangle Regional Partnership. Brantley walks crisply to his second-story office, which features a view of planes taking off every few minutes. 7:48. Brantley enters his office and prepares for a busier than usual day. That's because this is the third Thursday of the month, which, barring inclement weather or some other oddity, is always the day that the airport's eight-member governing body holds its monthly meetings. Brantley runs the airport, make no mistake about it, but ultimately he answers to the board, whose members are appointed by the commissioners in Wake, Durham counties, and the city councils of Raleigh and Durham. 7:50 a.m. Brantley fires up the computer and begins to check his emails. His office features a collection of knickknacks and decorations, from the operating certificate issued to RDU by the FAA to highly detailed models of commercial airplanes that have provided service at the airport, to a hard hat with the Washington Redskins logo on it. There also are pictures of his grandchildren, including a 9-year-old grandson, an 8-year-old step-grandson, and the newest arrival, an infant boy. Brantley is understandably proud. They're good little kids, he says. 7:56 a.m. Brantley is pleased to get an email announcing that a temporary USO will open in Terminal 2 the next day. The old USO facility opened several years ago, but now the organization is getting new space due to the Terminal 2 redevelopment project. It's an important facility for RDU since the airport has a lot of military personnel traveling through it. It really has turned out well, says Brantley. They really do a first-rate job. 8:15 a.m. Brantley spends the next couple of hours going through his email and conducting an interview with a reporter. Here are a few interesting nuggets. Brantley has a younger brother named Drew, but Brantley doesn't call him by his name. Instead, he simply calls him Brother. Brantley met Marilyn, an Illinois native, while he was in graduate school at Northwestern. She was a secretary in the civil engineering department, and Brantley definitely made a memorable first impression. She was an avid Lyndon Johnson supporter, he recalls. Barry Goldwater was my guy. We hit it off like oil and water, remembers Marilyn. We kidded a lot about the election and all. Easy for her to say. Her guy won. To hear Brantley tell it, his first date with Marilyn was a real hoot. His Corvair died in her driveway, and they had to take her Volkswagen to downtown Chicago, where they listened to live music. At one point, a performer asked if anybody present was from the South. Brantley raised his hand. The band responded by playing Dixie, and Brantley saluted during the performance. 10:13 a.m. Brantley visits with Aaron Locklear, the airport's in-house counsel, to talk about a couple of legal matters and to prepare items for the day's board meeting. 10:35. David Powell, the airport's director of major capital improvements, drops off a document for Brantley to review before the board meeting. Powell, who has been at the RDU airport for 31 years, says that a key to getting the Terminal 2 project done on time and on budget was the fact that Brantley and the RDU board allowed his team to do a lot of upfront planning. John's always been a pretty good strong leader here, says Powell, who adds that Brantley gives his team a lot of latitude and refrains from micromanaging. 10:57 a.m. Airport Authority Chairman Rob Teer huddles with Brantley for a pre-board meeting briefly, and Brantley has mixed news for Teer. RDU recorded positive seat growth for the month, but airport officials have just found out that Delta Airlines' daily flight to Los Angeles has been cut, at least on a seasonal basis. It's a disappointing setback since RDU has worked hard over several years to maintain and secure that non-stop route, but has been unable to maintain it on a permanent basis. 11:10 a.m. Brantley and Teer take the short walk down the hall to a conference room where the committee meetings are held. The main board meeting, which is held downstairs in the larger, more easily accessible room, doesn't start until 1 p.m. But the committee meetings, which are open to the public if you know where to go, are where the big decisions will be made anyway. Airport officials prefer to work out any disagreements in this narrow room, which will be stuffed with about 25 people, including staff and board members, but very few outsiders, instead of airing their dirty laundry in the more public setting 2 hours later. Votes in the main board meetings are overwhelmingly unanimous, and while there have been notable exceptions, the board generally tends to be deferential to the staff. Will there be any fireworks today? Teer doubts it. We're kind of a subdued operation, he says. 11:20. RDU's committee meetings are in full swing. Brantley listens to staff and board members give updates on everything from the airport's historically underutilized business program to the establishment of an airport-operated club for passengers. One important topic on the agenda today is the proposed renovation and consolidation of the big blue box known as Terminal 1. While the gigantic Terminal 2 redevelopment project won't be finished until January, RDU officials already are planning a makeover for its sister terminal that would cost around $60 million. The building's almost 30 years old, says Powell, and there are a lot of things that need to be addressed. 12 p.m. Authority board member Terry Yerrigan asked Brantley to sum up his overall strategy for renovating Terminal 1. Brantley responds that Southwest Airlines, RDU's largest major carrier, will operate in the central part of the terminal. The terminal also will have space for a couple of more carriers or expansion for Southwest. Brantley expects that the older portion of the facility that was constructed way back in 1955 will be torn down eventually, although the $60 million budget doesn't include the cost of that demolition. 12:13 p.m. Airport Authority member Michael Weeks wants to see how much some additional proposed work, such as a curbside canopy, might cost. With construction costs still low right now due to the fallout from the economic downturn, Brantley says the authority might be able to do more if it can get the contract on the street quickly enough. We tried to beat this to fit what we think we can afford to do, Brantley says of the renovation project. 12:24 p.m. Brantley proposes moving JetBlue Airways away from Terminal 1 to Terminal 2 in the spring of 2011 due to the impending renovation of the older facility. The board has no objection. 12:40 p.m. Board member Craigie Sanders wraps up the Law and Finance Committee meeting, and the board breaks for lunch. On the menu today, a chicken cordon bleu inspired entree, as well as salad, rice, pasta, and carrot cake. Brantley and the board members eat lunch and chat with each other up in the small conference room. The topics of conversation range from NC State-UNC football game to Sarah Palin's new reality show. 1:15 p.m. RDU's main board meeting starts in a large first-floor conference room. Brantley sits in his usual spot to the left of his board chairman, Tier. 1:28 p.m. Brantley presents the board with his formal monthly report on airport operations, always the highlight of any board meeting. He likes to pontificate on all things RDU, from air traffic numbers to federal aviation legislation to the occasional airline shenanigan. His candid, no-nonsense updates are like mother's milk to airport junkies, and the perfect wake-up call to rouse one from a coma induced by continuous rounds of unanimous votes. Brantley concludes by wishing everyone a happy Thanksgiving. We have a lot to be thankful for, both organizationally and personally, he says. 1:40 p.m. The authority adjourns into a closed session to discuss a legal matter. In March, the Airport Authority lost a year's court battle with several newspaper publishers that challenged RTU's ban of newspaper racks in its terminals. RTU is still working out how to proceed in the wake of the decision. Brantley can be stubborn sometimes, and as his doggedness in fighting the publishers illustrates. 2:56 p.m. The closed session finally ends. Brantley tracks down Powell and heads over to Terminal 2 for a tour of the construction progress of the facility's second phase. At this stage, the back hallways and rooms all still look the same, and there is a moment or two of reminiscence in that scene of the movie Spinal Tap, in which the band is wandering around unsuccessfully trying to find the stage. You understand why I didn't attempt early stages of planning next year's budget, he says. Correction. You understand why I didn't attempt this without him, Brantley says of Powell. I would have gotten lost a long time ago. 3:57 p.m. The tour concluded, Brantley drops Powell off and heads over for a brief visit to the General Aviation Terminal, where the airport's corporate and private planes are based. He takes the scenic route, which includes driving on restricted lanes that feature road signs warning of taxiing aircraft. A Bombardier Challenger on the tarmac catches Brantley's eye. Even after all these years, Brantley is still a passionate aviation enthusiast. That's a nice airplane right there, he says. 4:29 p.m. Brantley hurries back to the Airport Authority building for a budget meeting with Marketing Chief Teresa Domeno, Spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin, and Finance Director Tom Barrett. RDU's fiscal year ends March 31st, and airport officials already are in the early stages of planning next year's budget. 5:07 p.m. Brantley concludes the meeting with a traditionally Southern, "All right, thank y'all." He goes back to his office to read and respond to emails. 6 p.m. With the emails out of the way, Brantley is finally ready to call it a day. He heads home, where the after-work schedule includes dinner with his wife, cleaning and organizing in preparation for the impending arrival of one of his sons for Thanksgiving, and perusing his personal email. Tonight is more pedestrian than the day before, when he had dinner at the State Club before watching the Carolina Hurricanes battle the Ottawa Senators on television. There's no TV on tap for tonight, but he does manage to carve out some time for a little leisure reading. Air and Space Museum magazine. He's kind of low-key, Marilyn says of her husband's typical nightly routine. At 10 p.m., Brantley turns out the lights and goes to bed. Perhaps the best coda for the day was something he said hours earlier when asked what he liked about his job most. "It's been about as varied as you can ask for," Brantley said. "Having to stay in the same place and doing the same thing day after day would not have been my cup of tea." Next up, NCSU Museum to Get Chancellors Home, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. The 82-year-old Chancellor's residence at NC State University will undergo a $7.5 million renovation and expand to become home to a museum that since 1978 has quietly collected 27,000 pieces of art and other items that reflect the university's expertise in fields such as design and textile. Once Chancellor Randy Woodson and wife Susan move into a new $3 million residence on Centennial Campus in mid-2011, the work will begin in earnest to renovate the existing home fronting Hillsborough Street into the Gregg Museum of Art and Design. Lynn Ennis, curator of the museum, says the move will fulfill a dream long held by the museum staff and supporters. "It's such a little jewel, and we'll finally be in a position to exhibit our permanent collection," Ennis says. "Plus, will be more of a destination rather than just a place to come see when you come to lunch." For years, the museum's collection has been tucked away on the second and third floors of the Talley Student Center building. With the new $3 million Chancellor's Residence expected to be finished in mid-2011, and with the Talley Center to undergo a renovation, NCSU trustees in November approved the relocation of the museum. A request for design proposals to architecture and engineering firms has gone out for the renovation of the existing 7,950-square-foot Chancellor's Residence near Pullen Park and the Bell Tower. A 16,700-square-foot addition will be built for gallery space, administrative offices, and storage. University project manager Rachel Miller says design work for the new Gregg Museum space will begin in May, with construction beginning in October 2012. Ennis says museum supporters soon will launch a campaign to raise about $4.5 million to help cover construction costs. The university is expected to foot the remaining $3 million by allocating funds previously going to the museum to maintain its space at the Talley Center. Pat Hall, board president of the Friends of Gregg Volunteer Organization and a Raleigh fundraising consultant, says the museum's move to Hillsborough Street will help collect the university to other artistic events and exhibitions happening throughout the year in downtown Raleigh. "I think this is the best thing that could happen to the Gregg," Hall says. "It's a hidden jewel." The Gregg Museum has served as the collecting museum for the university since 1978 and operates under the Division of Student Affairs. Student fees fund its operations. It was formerly known as the Visual Arts Center and then the Gallery of Art and Design before it was renamed the John N. and Nancy C. Gregg Art Museum, Museum of Art and Design, in 2007 after a generous donation from the couple's estate. John Gregg was a former chair of the NC State Board of Trustees and a longtime supporter of the museum. "The museum collects what the university teaches," says Ennis, who serves as associate director of the museum and curator of the collection. She helps organize 6 to 8 exhibitions a year at the Talley Center and around campus that feature couture clothing, furniture, textiles, ceramics, folk art, photography, and architectural drawings that have been donated to the museum by NCSU faculty, alumni, and other supporters. continuing inside the front cover. Contractor says it cannot finish highway work. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, Thompson Contracting has stopped work on the widening of T.W. Alexander Drive in Durham and has notified the State Department of Transportation officials that it won't be able to finish the job. Thompson in February began work on the $6.5 million project to widen T.W. Alexander Drive between Cornwallis Road and NC-147. Now NCDOT officials say they are unsure when work will begin again. It is very unfortunate, and this will set us back, says Wally Bowman, division engineer for the NCDOT's Division 5 region, which includes Wake and Durham counties. This is very rare. They are only the third contractor that I can recall having to do this. Thompson Contracting 3 years ago was among the largest specialty contracting construction firms in the Triangle with 280 employees. Thompson's contract with NCDOT was backed by a surety bond from Fidelity and Deposit Company of Maryland, a business unit of Zurich Financial Services Group, which guaranteed performance of the construction contract. Surety bonds are typically required for government work projects, and premiums for contractors can range from 0.5% to 2% of the contract amount, depending on the size, type, and duration of a project, according to the Surety Information Office in Washington, D.C. Bowman says he received a letter from Fidelity and Deposit on December 14th stating that Thompson was voluntarily in default because of its inability to financially complete the project. Bowman says the bonding company will be responsible for hiring another contractor to finish the T.W. Alexander work. He hopes work can resume by spring. Contractors don't do a lot of work during this time of year anyway because of the weather. So if this was going to happen, this is the best time for this to have happened, he says. The T.W. Alexander Drive project is scheduled for completion by August 15th, unless state officials need to extend the deadline. Otherwise, the bonding company could be responsible for any liquidated damages or late fees. But $1,000 per day past the deadline, Bowman says. Bill Quinn, Senior Vice President of Surety for Wells Fargo Insurance Services in Charlotte, who is not affiliated with Thompson, says bonding companies don't usually get involved in a project unless there's no other option. Generally, the bonding company will send in claims people to determine if the contractor is capable of completing the project, and they will try to find the least cost to them to finish the project, he says. Sometimes the existing contractor is paid to finish the work. The more expensive option is to hire a different company. According to a McGraw-Hill construction survey of top specialty contracting firms in the Southeast, Thompson ranked among the five largest excavation and utility contractors with revenue of $42.24 million in 2008. Thompson posted $52 million in revenue in 2007. However, the company was not listed in Southeast Construction's magazine 2010 report. Thompson Contracting owner Bobby Thompson Jr. did not return calls for comment. The office building for Thompson Contracting at 101 Petfinder Lane is on the market for sale with a list price of $2.9 million. Thompson's family home near Garner is also for sale at $1.4 million, which is reduced from a list price of $1.95 million in July. Tim Barnes, a colleague of Thompson who co-owns Triton Sitework Development in Raleigh, wrote in an email message, "I can tell you that it is sad to watch another company fall during these unfortunate times." Next up, milking technology. Produce freshener delivering millions to NC State. By James Gallagher. From Raleigh, NC State University may have hit gold with its apple freshness system. The university's SmartFresh technology is a hefty contributor to revenue generated from technology license to the private sector. For the 2010 fiscal year, which ended in June, tech transfer revenue amounted to $5.1 million. A breakdown of 2010 numbers isn't available, but in 2009, NCSU realized more than $2 million in SmartFresh revenue created by a licensing arrangement with Rahm and Haas, a subsidiary of Dow Chemical. SmartFresh is a gas that stops the production of ethylene in apples, extending the apple's shelf life. SmartFresh revenue represented a significant portion of total technology transfer revenue of $4.9 million in fiscal year 2009. That was up by 36% from the year before, according to figures compiled by the Association of University Technology Managers. Bill Hotling, NCSU's Director of Technology Transfer, says that given ROM and Haas's financial projections and plans to expand the technology to produce in addition to windfalls, apples, NCSU could see a huge windfall in technology transfer revenue in the coming years. We're about halfway through the life cycle of this partnership, says Hotling. The numbers they have forecasted show there could still be significant increases from the revenue of this technology. NCSU also saw revenue from its plant varieties, such as corn, tobacco, and ornamental sweet potatoes, exceed $1 million, and that revenue is also expected to grow. Despite those advances, NCSU still has a long way to go before it catches up with some of the bigger players in technology transfer based on AUTM's annual licensing survey for fiscal year 2009. Northwestern University was a big winner in 2009, taking in nearly $161.6 million in licensing revenue, followed by Columbia University at $154.2 million, and New York University at $113.1 million. The report, released in late December, serves as a point of reference for university technology transfer officials, letting them know how many research licenses institutions signed, how many licenses a university has active, and how many companies were spun out of the university, and how many patents were filed and granted. Within the triangle, Duke University remains the big player, taking in $19 million in 2009, up from $15.6 million in 2008. Much of that growth, says Bob Tabor, Duke University's Vice Chancellor for Corporate and Venture Development, is due to expanded sales of the Duke-created drug Myozyme. The drug, which is licensed by Genzyme, is a treatment for the rare and often fatal Pompe's disease. The discovery of the drug was chronicled in the film Extraordinary Measures with Harrison Ford and Brendan Fraser. Tabor says Duke is at a point at which it consistently receives between $15 million and $20 million in licensing revenue annually, and that could rise if sales of Krystexxa, a treatment for gout approved this year by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, take off. Krystexxa is being licensed to a small drug developer. Savient Pharmaceuticals, though Duke officials hope that the firm is bought by a larger player that could boost sales. UNC Chapel Hill lags behind its triangle competitors, having yet to develop a major product, says Kathy Ennis, the university's technology development director. While UNC's revenue inched up to $3 million in 2009 from $2.8 million in 2008, the bulk of that comes from licensing fees and not product revenue. We still don't have most of our products in the market, says Ennis, adding that most of UNC's research licenses are for therapeutics that are in the early stages of development. She says it could be 7 to 10 years before that work advances to a marketable product and larger dollars start flowing in. All UNC really needs is for one of its therapeutics to become a blockbuster treatment. NYU took in more than $791 million in 2007, tech transfer revenue after selling its rights to a drug for $650 million. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the philanthropy news desk of Todd Cohen, Boys and Girls Clubs plots fundraiser. In the Wake County Public Schools, 78.2% of students who enter ninth grade graduate. At the Boys and Girls Club serving Wake County, 99.8% of members graduate, as well as 100% of kids who are members for 4 years or more. We've been here 43 years, says Ralph Capps, executive director of the Wake Clubs. We're a proven product that has a tremendous amount of impact in the communities we serve. That impact and the need to expand the organization to address growing demand for services is the focus of the organization's annual fundraising drive, which kicks off February 15th, as well as a capital campaign, still in a quiet phase, that began early 2010. Led by Board Chair Gordon Brown, Chief Financial Officer at Alfred Williams & Company, and co-chaired by Mark Lee, president of Baker Roofing, and Kevin Carlin, Southeast Director at Millennium Pharmaceuticals, the annual drive aims to raise $1.2 million, up from the $1.1 million raised in the 2010 drive. Key to that effort will be roughly 200 volunteers. Also key will be online fundraising, a feature that Boys and Girls Clubs launched this year that generated roughly $50,000 for the 2010 drive. The annual drive provides operating funds for the organization, which operates 7 clubs and a summer day camp. In the fiscal year that ended June 30, the organization served just over 4,300 children and teens, up 5% from the previous year. Keeping pace with rising demand for services fueled by Wake's growing population is a key goal of the capital campaign, which has a goal of $12 million and already has raised nearly $4 million in its quiet phase. Set to kick off its public phase July 1, the campaign is co-chaired by Prentice Baker III, chairman of Baker Roofing. Michael Dickinson, Vice President for Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, and community volunteer Noel Lichten. With funds from the campaign, the Boys and Girls Clubs aim to serve an additional 2,000 young people over the next decade. Campaign funds will be used to build a new facility at the Zebulon Boys and Girls Clubs to serve 1,000 kids, replacing a trailer that now serves 400 kids. Build a new teen center on Raleigh Boulevard to serve 500 kids and house the organization's administrative offices, and improve the current camp facility in Nash County. Funds will also be used to renovate buildings, buy new vehicles, provide startup funds to support programs in low-income areas the clubs do not currently serve, and increase the club's endowment to $5.5 million from $2.5 million. While the organization traditionally has counted on staff and longtime volunteers to raise money, the success of the campaign will depend on enlisting a younger generation of volunteers, Cap says. If we're going to continue to have an impact on the community, he says, we need to bring in younger leaders to be part of the organization. Continuing on the inside, transit agency fails in effort to recover $400,000 from firm. By Chris Basden. From the Research Triangle Park. Triangle Transit has struck out in its attempt to recover more than $400,000 from Niles Bolton Associates Incorporated, an Atlanta architecture firm that provided station design services on the authority's failed first attempt to build a regional rail system. The disagreement centered around Byzantine accounting procedures, including whether or not Niles Bolton had properly documented its bonus compensation using what are called federal acquisition regulations. The dispute was really one of those that only lawyers and accountants could love, says Charles Rogers, an attorney at Smith Curry and Hancock LLP who represented Niles Bolton. Arcane though it may have been, the dispute involved big money. Triangle Transit sought a refund of $433,152 it already had paid Niles Bolton. Instead, arbiter James Nagel in late November denied Triangle Transit's claim and granted an NBA counterclaim of $23,519, additional money that the agency now will have to pay Niles Bolton. Triangle Transit is obviously disappointed by the arbitrator's decision, General Counsel Wib Gully wrote in an email response to questions. We share the view of our financial and accounting consultant in the case, the national accounting firm of Cherry Beckert Holland, that the case was wrongly decided. Gully says that by prior arrangement of the parties, the arbiter's decision is final. The agency has funds in this year's budget to pay the additional amount that was awarded. Rogers was understandably pleased with the arbitrator's decision, saying, I feel my client has been vindicated. Rogers also contends that this is a dispute that never should have gone as far as it did. Gully in the email says that the Triangle Transit pursued a financial review because it was required to do so under federal law. Failing to pursue the matter would have left Triangle Transit open to the charge of misallocation of federal funds, and the agency could have been forced to repay the money in question, he says. Triangle Transit has been more successful in similar reviews of other contractors that worked on the previous rail project. Reviews of those contractors have led to the agency receiving funds of $329,444, according to Triangle Transit CFO Sondra Freeman. After the additional payment, Triangle Transit will have paid Niles Bolton and the subcontractors that the architecture firm employed a total of nearly $16.7 million. NBA worked on the previous rail project from 2003 to 2006. Triangle Transit pulled the plug on that 28-mile system in August 2006 because it had failed to win a long-term federal funding commitment. In the end, Triangle Transit spent more than $150 million on the defunct project. The agency now is working on a renewed effort to build a rail system in the region. Pension fund stares at $330 million loss on securities program. A lending program offers its stocks and bonds for hedge funds to conduct short-selling trades. By Lee Weisbrecher from Raleigh. State pension officials have been looking at potential losses of as much as $330 million on a securities lending program that once was considered a near-automatic moneymaker. Securities lending is when a pension fund makes some of its stocks and other assets available to hedge funds, brokers, and other market makers who use the securities for short-selling activities but intend to return them to the pension fund down the road. For using its assets, North Carolina requires such clients to hand over an amount of cash collateral equal to 102% of the value of the stock loaned out. The cash is returned when the stock comes back to the state, but in the meantime, the state and the outside managers put the money into short-term investments, aiming to get an extra return. In fiscal 2010, which ended June 30th, the North Carolina pension system had invested $6.5 billion in such collateral cash, down 31% from the prior year. Beginning with the financial meltdown of 2008, however, some of the state's investments with collateral cash have tumbled in value, thus far producing unreal losses of $329.5 million, according to the Office of North Carolina Comptroller David McCoy. Against the day when those paper losses become real ones, the North Carolina Treasurer's Office has set up a special reserve account, which, as of June 30th, contained $141.2 million. Controller spokeswoman Sherry Johnson, when asked about the securities lending program, referred all questions on the matter to the Treasurer's Office. Repeated requests for comment from the Treasurer's Office were not answered. But Enos Cupp, the Chicago-based consultant hired to review the pension, identified the two outside custodians making North Carolina's security lending deal as State Street and Bank of New York Mellon. After examining the program in 2010, Enos Cupp issued a report recommending, among other things, that pension managers needed to create a more robust process of monitoring the security lending program and cash collateral reinvestment. The decision of the securities lending program, the most comprehensive to date in any published state records, was included in the 2010 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, also known as CAFR, released by the Comptroller's Office in the week of December 20th. The investments made with North Carolina securities lending collateral vary from higher-yield corporate bonds to unspecified asset-backed securities to repo agreements, a security sale and resale. During the market crisis of 2008, according to the CAFR, a Lehman Brothers bank note purchased in the state's name with securities lending and collateral defaulted. Since that time, CAFR adds, several other securities with potential losses were identified. In response, the state directed that all proceeds derived from the securities lending be deposited in a special reserve account to offset expected losses. Proceeds from securities lending would normally be used as cash source to help the state government meet its short-term needs. North Carolina hasn't been the only state to deal with ups and downs in the securities lending area. CalPERS, the California Pension System, reported $634 million in potential losses on collateral investments as of late March. Yet, spokesman Wayne Davis says, while reviewed regularly, the practice is still used by CalPERS to generate returns. And now, money matters. Durham Cafe Brews mixed results. Solid October sales followed by a dip in November as Cafe creates new offerings. From Durham, Dorian Bolden, having again made coffee the focal point of Bayou Cafe, saw business perk up in October before cold weather and the holidays put a damper on sales. Clearing the cobwebs that had clouded his vision for the downtown Durham establishment he founded a year ago, Bolden has now had time to reshape the cafe's reflection in its customers' eyes. Still the number one reason people darken the doors of the cafe, the simple cup of Joe, is the drilled-down core of why it exists. Things make sense now, Bolden says. Before, I didn't realize what the business had become because things were moving so fast. The steps Bolden and his team at Bayou Cafe have implemented to simplify the business started to show positive results on its balance sheets in October. The establishment's total gross sales for the month, which clocked in roughly at $63,000, were up $13,000 from what it recorded in September. Bolden points to a few reasons why the first full month of fall proved to be a banner month for the cafe. It's about knowing what works and knowing what your customers want, Bolden says. He references a new slimmed-down menu as one of the keys to the upswing. Everyone loves the new menu, and we are able to execute our offerings much better now, Bolden says, of the simplified small-plate food offerings. Bayou is now able to offer more varied choices and keep its food costs lower, he says. Another big change is a much wider selection of coffee choices. Bolden says he's given his employees the freedom to concoct some of their own coffee creations, a choice he says is due to the abilities of his staff. We have a very creative team here, says Bolden. Some of the creativity is now needed to find ways to beef up the cafe's holiday business. Total gross sales in November dipped about 8% from the October number, and the projected December sales figure is on pace to equal or inch past November's performance, Bolden says. So, what's been the root cause of Bayou's sluggish holiday sales? The answer is twofold, Bolden says, adding that the two main culprits so far have been the Thanksgiving holiday and the recent snow days that kept potential customers at bay. Because the margins are so slim in the restaurant business, every day is crucial. The books need to be watched with a close eye constantly. Absolutely every day matters, Bolden says. Extenuating circumstances caused an interruption in business on a few of those recent days. The Thanksgiving holiday hurt us, Bolden says, adding that a few recent snow, icy mixture weather events didn't help matters either. There were about 5 days in November that were affected by disruptions beyond the cafe's control, he says. Though Bolden and his team still have to watch trends closely, Bayou Cafe has survived the critical one-year mark, reaching the milestone on December 9th. When asked what he has taken away from the experience of running his own business, Bolden reflects on the relationships that he has been able to forge and cultivate in the past year. That has been the biggest thing for me, he says. Also the fact that I have a good product. Mark Noel, chairman of the Noel Group and also major investor in Bayou Cafe, is pleased with Bolden's efforts to improve the business and the community at large. He has been very successful in what he told his investors, Noel says. I can see that he is working incredibly hard and adding real value to downtown Durham. As he gazes into his crystal ball for 2011, Bolden says he sees more opportunities for Bayou in two major areas. First, getting his coffee in more venues, including restaurants. The cafe already has a significant presence in the Durham Performing Arts Center, the Carolina Theater of Durham, and the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce. Further developing those relationships and gaining access to other establishments is important to the future of the cafe, he says. The second major push for 2011 is to get the cafe open for Sunday brunch. We've seen a huge demand for coffee on Sundays, Bolden says. Next up, the local expert. Question. What advice do you have for a startup restaurateur to properly maintain good record keeping for a fast-paced environment whereby I receive a multitude of different invoices a week, write several different checks a week, and deal with daily cash deposits inflow from customers? What exactly should I be doing to stay better organized and ensure I stay on top of my business? Pamela Brinkley, shareholder of Thomas Knight Trent King & Company, answers, Mr. Bolden is in business because he loves providing an excellent cup of coffee to his customers in a friendly environment. He may not love the paperwork that goes with operating a business, though. The key for a business owner is to determine the financial information that is important to make informed business decisions and concentrate his or her time on that information. Focus on the important data. Spend as little time as possible on the remainder. there are a handful of key financial components for the restaurant industry. These components include sales revenue, food and beverage cost, and labor cost. The prudent business person concentrates on tracking these costs weekly, comparing the information to previous weekly reports, and understanding the factors that show improvement or deterioration in the current profitability of the business. In a high-volume, low-margin business, a small problem can quickly hurt profits, while small improvements may quickly improve profitability. How does this relate to paperwork overload? The majority of the owner's bookkeeping activities and paperwork management must enhance his understanding of the key profit factors of the business. The remainder of the paperwork is of much less importance, and minimal time should be spent on it. In a restaurant business, cash is king. Limit access to cash, including charge card receipts, count and summarize it daily. Protect it from theft. Carefully monitor and record daily any payments out of cash for products or services. Focus on maintaining an accurate and current check register, either in paper or electronic form. The check register records the payments for food cost and labor. The majority of the time spent in maintaining cash disbursement information should be targeted to benefit understanding of the costs that lead to the weekly profit analysis. The remainder of the cost may fall into the account for overhead. In a quiet moment, Mr. Bolden should take a hot cup of coffee, sit at a quiet corner table, and think about the key information he needs to understand the profitability of his business. Make his 2011 New Year's resolution to maximize his time in the financial areas that make his business profitable, and understand that the paperwork will always be there. This week's guest column is from Steve Simonovich. Old snowmen just melt away. For me, the joy of the holidays is always tempered by the sad tale of Frosty the Snowman. Frosty, as we know, had issues. This man of snow, for that is by definition what Frosty is, or rather was, laughed and played in a simpler time, 1950s America. Yet a closer look at his behavior suggests that he needed counseling. With the benefit of professional help, he might have lived a full and happy life. Instead, Frosty's life was marked by mood swings and erratic behavior. This led to his demise. Frosty the Snowman would have been 71 years old today. Back in Frosty's heyday, America was considered the sound mental health capital of the world. Our nation retained that designation until 1962, when Liechtenstein captured the title. Since that time, the U.S. mental state has continued to slip. Experts now estimate that 1 in 4 Americans suffer some form of mental illness. Others say that number is closer to 9 in 10, particularly during the morning and evening commute hours. Among white male, middle-aged snowmen, the rate is even higher. These statistics help explain the surge in interest in Frosty, the former man of snow, and why he remains relevant today. Yet little is known about Frosty, the man, the myth, the legend. Where was he born? Who were his parents? Did he have a girlfriend? I have dedicated my life, well, not all of it, just some of it, to the study of Frosty. I have found scant information about his birthplace or upbringing. Based on my research, he appears to have had no significant relationship with anyone of the opposite sex, although one obscure reference alludes to a boyhood crush on an igloo cooler. Ultimately, I've found the only reliable source of information about Frosty the Snowman to be the lyrics to the song of the same name. I have studied these lyrics extensively, going as far as to memorize them and singing them aloud at holiday parties. I've also have played recorded versions of the tune backwards in search of hidden messages. For example, played in reverse, the words thumpity-thump-thump sound much like mump-a-pump, mump-a-pump, which translated from Inuit to English means, turn me on, Desmond. These words would appear to have no significance in Frosty's life. One thing we can say with certainty, however, is this. Frosty was a smoker. One can only speculate what his corncob pipe played in his unraveling. Why was the pipe always in his mouth? And what was in the pipe? Taking in historical context, Frosty's affinity to the corncob pipe was not unusual. Yet Frosty did not seem to have full control of his senses when a heat wave hit. He knew the sun was hot that day, which coincides with records kept by the National Weather Service. Yet he grabbed a broomstick and ran to the village square, daring a crowd of onlookers to catch me if you can. Unfortunately, Frosty chose poorly. He eluded arrest, but soon afterwards, the mercury topped 80 degrees. Still, some Frosty followers find inspiration in his last words. I'll be back again someday. With proper treatment, he might never have left. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The web address for the Triangle Radio Reading Service is www.triangleradioreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.